Excited to welcome University of Idaho basketball coach Arthur Marrera to the Basketball Podcast. Marrera was the 2025-26 Big Sky Coach of the Year, as Idaho swept the Big Sky, winning the regular season title, the conference tournament championship, and earning an NCAA tournament berth for the first time in a decade. It marked the program's first regular season conference crown since 2019 and its first Big Sky tournament title and NCAA appearance since the 2015-16 season. Marrera made history as the first Brazilian head coach in NCAA Division I basketball, leading the Vandals through one of the most successful seasons in program history. Hey, coach, brief interruption from your podcast to hear from one of our top supporters, Hoopsalytics. Is your starting lineup not performing to your expectations? What if your star player is injured? Who should you play together instead? You can answer questions like this using the powerful Hoopsalytic basketball platform to reveal your most productive players and lineups. Just ask the AI assistant, and based on extensive player and lineup stats and analytics, you'll get accurate, data-driven answers instantly. You can literally ask anything about teams and players and then start making even better strategic decisions. Hoopsalytics also provides top-tier video link stats with a 12-hour turnaround time, as well as handy visualizations, interactive shot charts, coaching stats, easy-to-create film sessions, and lots more. And unlike the alternatives, you get unlimited video storage with no hidden fees. Best of all, Hoopsalytics is more affordable. Now in year 7, Hoopsalytics is a true game changer for thousands of basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball and start using advanced stats and AI to win more games today. Coach Marrera, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I've been a fan for years, listened to it quite often. It's an honor to be here with you.
Honor to have you on. What a season. And we'll dive into that season and everything that you did at Idaho. But let's first start with the Brazilian connection. That's very cool. Anytime you can say you're the first of the first Brazilian to be a Division I head coach, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's been a crazy journey. It's been fun to see not only to have this opportunity, but to have a lot of people from back home reach out to me. There's a lot of Brazilian coaches that always wanted to coach in the U.S. and coach college basketball. And sometimes you don't know the best path to take. So it's been really cool for me to get those people to reach out to me, try to help. And even international coaches in general, there's not many of us that are head coaches at the Division I level. So hopefully that can open some doors for more people because there's a lot of good coaches overseas.
Darko with the Raptors, the first international head coach in the NBA to make the playoffs. So a lot of firsts happening, and you and I both know we've traveled a lot. So we know there's great coaching everywhere in the world. And yeah, a lot of fun. And what a great story this year. Incredible success for the team. You won everything you could possibly win getting into the NCAA tournament, taking care of business in the Big Sky. So talk a little bit about that team that you got to coach this year.
Yeah, this group was really special. Throughout my career as a player, as an assistant coach, as a manager, as a head coach, I don't think I've ever seen a team that would never waver as much as this group. They were so mentally tough. And once we started on that stretch where we won 18 games in a row, there was never a game where I look in their eyes, no matter how bad it was, that they thought they were going to lose the game. They stayed poised. They stayed controlled. And they kept playing for each other. They just kept finding ways to win. And it's really special. It started the recruiting process, the type of people that we bring in. I think that they just decided to completely buy in what we were doing, buy into each other. It's one of those seasons that maybe at some point we'll break the record right again, but it's definitely a group that I'll never forget.
A bit of a two-year process for you, obviously, in terms of the build to this point. It didn't happen overnight, but it did happen very quickly. So maybe give us some of those keys in terms of that quick turnaround from you becoming the head coach to, obviously, this season.
There's a lot of mixed opinions on the transfer portal, right? Especially nowadays with rev share and all the crazy landscape we live in college athletics. I've always been a fan of it because I think it gives programs a chance to rebuild quickly. Not too far ago, maybe we're talking 5-6 years, and it would be a 4 or 5 year process to rebuild the program. When I took the job here before the 24-25 season, we only had 2 players on the roster. Wow. So we had to go and sign 13 new girls and mesh them together. The situation where I got the job was a little weird. So it was later in the year. So I missed that first window of the transfer portal. So We just decided to go get good kids that year one that would work hard, would be in the gym. My coaches and I, we have this philosophy that I'd much rather be on the floor than doing paperwork in the office. So sometimes I get in trouble with my admin because it takes me a while to get respond to emails and get my paperwork done. But I wanted kids, I wanted to be in the gym. So that was even more important than talent year one. So we brought tons of good kids in. Anytime you walk into our gym, whether it's 6 a.m., 7 p.m., 8 p.m., you're going to see one of our girls there getting a workout in, either with a coach or by themselves. So that first group was really important because of that. We wanted competitive kids that want to work hard, and they set the tone. We had some really talented freshmen that came in. We had three freshmen that first year that they all developed, and two of them ended up starting for us this year, and one was our sixth man. So I felt like he helped them learn from those seasoned vets. We had a lot of Division II transfers that won a lot of games. I think that's always impactful. It's hard to win, no matter the level that you're in. And those girls just brought a different identity to our team. And then he carried over to this year that now we had a full off season and we're able to get some pretty good talent. People always ask me, how are you guys so good at recruiting transfers? And I tell them the keys to recruit high school. Because all the girls that we got in the transfer portal for this year are the girls that told me no the first time.
Great
So,
advice. Yeah, no, I remember my
yeah.
college program and University of Windsor. Everyone wanted to go to the US. So
Yeah.
I'd recruit them whether they were going to go to the US or not, because you'd get them on the way back sometimes. So
Yeah.
fully
That
understand the
that's what
philosophy.
happened with this year's roster. Every single transfer we signed, it's somebody. Two of them, I signed them to the University of San Francisco when I was an assistant there. The other four are girls that I recruited out of high school, and they chose to go elsewhere. So they decided to come back and play for me now. So when people ask me, what's your secret to be so good in the portal? I always tell them, you got to spend time recruiting them in high school because they'll remember that. Yeah.
Another thing that stands out for me from doing a deep dive in terms of you and your background and your style a little bit is that, and it shows here already, you seem to have fun. You seem to love it. And that's
Yeah.
reflected in the fact that, of course, you'd rather be on the court than do paperwork.
Oh, I'm so lucky to do what we do. This has been my dream. Basketball has been my life. I honestly don't know if it didn't work out, if I'll be able to contribute to the society because I don't know how to do anything else. Just been around the game since I was little, whether watching, playing, coaching, and I get to wear shorts to work every single day and spend most of my hours in a basketball court. I don't understand. I get all the stress, the pressure, the transfers, all the money conversations. But I'd much rather be doing this than anything else. So I never take it for granted. It's always, every single day I come to work, it's like this. I'm always smiling. I'm always excited to work.
That's so good. And that's obviously your girls must love that as well, and your staff and your administration. And I'm just nodding my head because wearing shorts was my number one goal. There's no question. Never
Oh,
having to wear pants to work or something like that. So I
I
told.
had to go to this fundraiser this weekend and I couldn't find my suit because I haven't worn it so long. So I had to. It took me a couple of days to figure out where it was.
Yeah, though that's so funny. That's awesome. You said in an interview that this wasn't a magic season, but a standard being built. Talk to us about that.
I always say I don't believe in rebuilds. If I can't compete for a championship, then I'm not doing my job. I feel like our administration, they give us great support. I'm biased, but I think we have one of the most beautiful arenas in the country, certainly at the mid-major level on the West Coast. Our girls get everything they need. We have a really good nutrition department, really good athletic trainers, strength and conditioning. So if I'm not up there every year, top three in the league, trying to compete for a championship, then my admin can be mad at me and I deserve to get yelled at the end of the season. But yeah, this is the standard. We did it last year as year one. We won 18 games, finished third. And I told the girls when we lost in the first round of the conference tournament, remember this because we got to make sure our program is never in the situation again. We never want to lose in the first round of the NCAA or the Big Sky tournament, getting upset. We want to make it to the championship game. We want to play for a spot in the NCAA tournament. And that's the standard moving forward now. And I don't know if the standard will be winning 29 games because that's hard to do again. But at least competing for a spot in the NCAA tournament, that's going to be our standard.
Yeah, absolutely. And you already mentioned the concept of being in the gym with your players. And I know that's one of your unique approaches is that this emphasis on player development and individual workouts to the point that you reduce regular practice time so that they feel like they have more energy, more interest in coming back and doing the individual workouts. I love that. Can you talk more about that philosophy?
It all started because of the new landscape of recruiting, right? We're not going to compete with all the big dogs and how much we can pay our players, so we got to get them better. And I've always believed in that. I think nowadays, especially with how hard it is to retain players, if you can have people in your program for multiple years continue to improve, that's the key to be successful. And we don't do any skill breakdown in our team practice. I try to keep our practice to an hour and a half, 2 hours max. They very rarely go over that. So then they'll have energy, they'll have time to come back and get an individual workout. We get after it too. Every Sunday, my associate head coach, Drew, who's in charge of probably development, he'll send a spreadsheet to the team. All of our coaches will block out the times they have meetings. Like right now, if I send you the spreadsheet, I blocked out this time so we could talk. But right after we're done, I'm hopping back on the court. And then our players can go and sign up with coaches for as many individuals as they want. Now, during the off season is a little tricky because of the hours, right? The limitations. So we have to limit them to two or three, depending on how long we go, because we only have 4 hours on the court. But even during the regular season, we're playing games, we're still getting individual workouts in. I don't have positional coaches like a lot of programs, a post coach and a guard coach. And the reason for that is throughout my experience recruiting transfers, they've always had me. I always ask the question before agents were a thing, who's helping you with your decision? And they always said, oh, my positional coach. I got really close to the guard coach or the post coach, and they're not close to the rest of the staff. So I want to promote that environment where our players have an opportunity to meet all of our coaches and same way our coaches can meet our players. So we'll have more specialty coaches. Like Drew is really good at the details. He'll break down moves, break down footwork. He, in my opinion, he's the best teacher I've ever been around. Derek Sage is a really good shooting coach. He does a great job getting our girls in the gym and helping them with their shots and getting game-like reps. Lindsay does a really good job with the ball handling, the toughness side of it. And then for me, I just want to make them die out there on the workout. So we go hard in everything that we do when they work out with me. So that way the girls can choose who they're going to work out with each day of the week. We all follow the same plan. We build a database of skill sets that we want our players to develop. So even if you sign up with me on Monday, Lindsay on Tuesday, Drew on Wednesday, we have our own styles, but we're still following the same plan for each individual player. And that gives them a chance to get close to anybody on the staff. And in the recruiting process, I tell the players, my job is to develop you guys, but it's to develop my coaches too. So I want them to get head coaching opportunities. And then when they leave, I don't want you to just be close to your guard coach, because then if he gets a head coaching job, now you feel like nobody on the staff has your back. So yeah, that's my philosophy.
It's a great philosophy. And the part that connects for me, as you know from following, is a little bit of the evidence-based part of that, which is the variability. Like instead of working with the same person and getting used to the same thing, the actual moving around to different coaches makes a lot of the things that your players do more adaptable because they're getting variability automatically.
No, I try to throw as much stuff at them as possible because you and I share this philosophy. It's hard to replicate games. Games are not going to be scripted. So in everything we do in practice and individual workouts, I always try to add the variable factor to it. So we're building that into their brains and they're training that. So when the game happens, they know how to react.
I love that. And not having positional coaches, I couldn't agree more. What is a position nowadays, anyways? Basketball player is the key part of that. And the thing that shines through well as well, and I know you mentioned this to me before, but this concept of relationship-based program. And a lot of coaches say it, but let us know, how do you bring that to life?
Yeah, I try to connect with our players as much as I can. Now it got to the point where it's a little easier because we have a lot of returners, so they know that our office doors are always open. But my first year, we had a lot of transfers that they felt like going to the head coach's office is like the principal's office, right? You only go when you're in trouble. So I got this from my previous boss, Carrie Amy, who's the head coach at South Dakota now. So that first year, I put up a sign-up sheet in my door. And every single day, the players have to come inside their names one time. You don't have to stay and talk. You don't have to say hi. You can just put your name on my door and then move on. But that builds that habit of coming to the office. It's okay to come and hang out. It's okay to be here. And I thought that was key for that first year. You build that habit on them. And then all the returners, I didn't need to do that as much this year because they'll come to the office anyway. So it's,
So now they know it's a welcoming place and it's a good place to be. And obviously, you're non-threatening and non-judgmental and welcoming, right?
Yeah, no doubt it. And I'm always consistent. They learn by now. I can get mad at them in practice. Even if we had a bad practice, we're going to hold them to a standard. But once practice is over, even if it's 30 minutes after they come to my office, I'm the same person every day. It doesn't matter what happened on the court. So I feel like that helps them feel comfortable with coming in as well.
I was going to ask you, balancing the intensity with the psychological safety, the enjoyment, the welcoming we already talked about. So talk to us about balancing that.
Yeah, we try to make practice as competitive as possible. I think there's two ways to get your kids to play hard and be intense. One, you can yell at them the whole time and make them hate you and fear you. And two, you just create that environment, that competitive environment. So our preseason, we'll have our teaching drills that are a little slow, But right after I teach something, I always find a way to compete. If we're working on specific footwork or a passing drill or rebounding, shooting, we'll find a way to compete, and then we'll stat everything. So if we're doing a passing drill, there's going to be a winner, there's going to be a loser. My managers, my GAs, they keep a tally of who won and who lost that day. Then after practice, they'll add to a spreadsheet. And then every Sunday in the locker room, I'll post the wins for the week on every drill, whether it's 5-on-5, 3-on-3, rebounding, passing, anything we do. So I think numbers are a very effective way to teach because they don't lie. So if somebody goes on Sunday and they see they're at the bottom, their approach the next week changes without me having to say anything to them. And that go as far as everything we do, even defensive principles, rebounding. I find a way to create stats that align with our fundamentals. So we're very unique in how we defend. So one of our concepts is the pin area, for example. So if the ball's ever in the pin area, they get a point if they pin, they get minus one if they don't pin. So we post all of that in the locker room. So when they look at the stats and they see, oh, I only pin 10% of the time, it doesn't make them feel very good. So they make a conscious effort to change it without us having to just yell at them the entire practice.
Talk to us about the pin area since you went there, the pin area and the clear area that you divide the
Yeah.
court in two, right?
Yeah, so it's the pin area is interesting because there's always a little bit of gray, right? Unfortunately, in games, I can't keep my lines out there that I tape on the floor, right? To clearly define pretty much any time the ball is sided. So if you think of lane line extended, anything outside of that, we call it the pin area, and we're trying to keep people on one side of the floor. No matter if it's the left side or the right side, we don't force left, force right, none of that. We just try to keep them on that side. And then we play really heavy in gaps. And I'm a big peel switching guy. So even if you pin and you get blown by, there's gonna be somebody who's gonna step up to the ball before the ball even gets to the paint. And that's my goal is to eliminate paint touches. So whether it's by passing or by driving, we don't want people to get in there. And then we'll be a little scout based, but our base defense is any ball screens that happen in the pin area, we're probably gonna ice unless we change a scout. And in clear area, we're more butt to the basket. You're protecting your feet. You just don't want to get beat in the middle of the floor. So not as much pressure. Again, our goal is to keep people from getting inside the 3-point line, from getting to the paint. So anything that happens in the clear area, we're more likely to switch.
So to me, that creates a little bit more of a conceptual approach to defense. You do have some goals clearly, but how they achieve that and where they keep the ball, we're not hung up on where they're forcing, et cetera, as much as these are the areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it makes it simple for them. It takes them a while to get the hang of it, especially with the peel switching. It's not a concept that a lot of these girls know before they come here. But this year, I think, was the biggest proof of that. We're awful defensively early. We probably up to maybe January, we're one of the worst defensive teams in the country. And I'm not going to lie, I try to stay true to myself, but I thought about switching it up. I was like, man, we're not guarding, but I just believe in it so much. I was like, you know what? Instead of switching, we got to get better at it. And then the second half of conference, we end up being the number one defense in the conference and top 10 in the country. So it's once they pick up the concepts, it's really hard to play against.
Where did you start teaching peel switching? What did you do to teach that initially?
Yeah, we just start on the ball with 2-on-2 drills, basic concepts. I try to go everywhere on the floor because, again, it's hard to simulate where that help is going to come from and when people's going to peel. So I try to get them to understand why we're doing it. So I'll give them a bunch of different scenarios to try to explain the reason why. And then when stuff happens in the game that we have never drilled, they understand the concept and they'll do it. So as long as we train them to communicate the proper way, they understand that we have to stop the ball as soon as possible. It's not your traditional way of defense. There is a baseline drive, help is coming from the opposite corner. You wait for them to get close to the paint and then you step out and get them. It's like if somebody gets beat, you're stopping the ball. You're attacking the ball is the term that we use. To force him to pick the ball up. Because when you peel switch, there's going to be a little frame of time that somebody's going to be open, right? But if we attack the ball and we force them to put two hands on the ball, usually it takes them at least a second to put two hands on the ball and make a pass. And that's enough for us to peel in and rotate. So that's why it's important to be aggressive with it. So we do tons of scrambling drills, put them in different scenarios where I force that communication, I force them to understand. And then, when a situation that they are not familiar with happens, if they know the concept and they have a good understanding of why, then they're going to be ready to do it on their own.
I love that. I mean, and again, you're going to have hopefully a group in the future because I'm teaching this to 7th grade girls, and
Oh,
it's
perfect.
literally out of the 2-on-2 situations that you just talked about. And then what I've found, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, what I've found is, again, not having a rule or any rules helps them be way more adaptable with it. It's like, show what it looks like, rep that a few times, and then say, hey, now, my phrase, figure it out, figure it out. And they've actually got really good at it to the point, and I'm curious if you do this at all, to think a little bit about individual matchups and saying, oh, I can peel off this player faster. Or, oh my gosh, I see a big time shooter on the weak side. I got to get there faster, or I should stay longer because it's a bad size matchup or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's when the scout comes into part for us. We do exactly that. If you're guarding a non-shooter or somebody that is not that good of a shooter, even how deep you are in the gap changes. I feel like it makes it easier to be a peel switching team when you do play in gaps. I think it's hard to peel and deny at the same time. So if I'm one pass away and the person that I'm guarding is not a great shooter, I'm going to be low in having that gap because if my teammate, especially in the pin area, puts ball pressure and gets beat, I'm going to attack that ball and maybe let her dribble once or twice. Now, if it's a better shooter, maybe instead of peeling right away, I might stun at the ball and get my hands in that passing lane to make sure they can't get that easy kick out one pass away. So those are usually the things that are harder for them to get early in the season because it changes game to game. But again, like we said, if I give them a chance to figure out during the preseason, then they're going to do that during the game. I think coaching is always finding that balance of the answers you want to give them and the part that you want them to figure out on their own. Like, there's this soccer coach that I'm a big fan of. He coaches the Brazilian national team now, Carlo Ancelotti. And he says there's only two types of coaches out there, the ones that get in the way and mess everything up, and the ones that don't do anything. That's it. So I try to be the second one.
I love that. And most of us as coaches need to hear that because, again, we know the answer that we think works and we've had all these experiences and stuff. But the players being adaptable, I really do value beyond repeatability. And the way you practice obviously reflects that as well, where it's a lot of game based, a lot of competition. And I imagine you're not stopping it all the time to be able to say, no, you're wrong. You did this wrong.
No, yeah, I tried a minimum amount. Now, obviously, early, I probably stopped more than later in the season when we're trying to get them to understand the concepts. But we use film a lot as a teaching tool because I don't want to stop live practice if I don't have to. During the preseason, all of our girls, at least twice a week, they have individual film sessions with the coaches, myself included, where we break everything down and we use that as a teaching tool as well instead of just making practice 3 hours because I'm blowing my whistle every single time that something goes wrong.
You mentioned some of the struggles with peel switching. I get asked about peel switching a lot. We have some stuff in the community about it, but maybe highlight for coaches, what were some of the struggles, and then what were some of the ways that eventually you came to conclusions about continuing with it and buying into it?
Yeah, I think that there's two biggest struggles, especially when you start teaching it. One, if people's never done it before, I think it's so different than your traditional way of defending because sometimes we'll peel from the strong side corner. And I grew up learning that you should never do that,
No help
right?
off the ball side, I know.
Right. So like little situations like that, sometimes the girls look like a little cross-eyed and be like, why are we doing this? So I think that's a big struggle. It's just so different and so unique that they may not believe it right away. And the number one for me is the communication. You have to be a good communicating team because we use the term peel, and that's when your teammate knows that they don't need to chase the ball anymore. As soon as you hear that, you're peeling to the next person over. And I feel like at basketball at any level, especially on the girl side, they struggle with the communication piece of it. For us, that we have six different languages in our program, it's even harder, right? Especially those freshmen coming in from overseas, that they might not communicate as much. But funny enough, usually the international girls are the best ones at peeling because they've seen it before. So you just have to drill that communication. I think it has to be clear. It has to be efficient. I went away when I started teaching peel switching of talking when you're guarding the ball and just say the usual. I grew up this way, saying ball, ball the whole time. And I think that sometimes clogs the communication channels. So I tell them to communicate one time clear, and then I want the people around the ball, they need to be talking all time. So they need to be saying, hey, I'm in your gap, I'm in your gap. And then when it happens, they call the peel. The person on the ball, I want them to be focused on the ball and focused on listening their teammates telling where the help is.
I'm with you on this. Like, we've grown up with an obsession with defensive communication, and sometimes to the detriment of actually players executing what's the best situation without someone, again, predetermining what you should do. So I love that example. That's such a powerful example. Hey, coach, I'm excited to let you know that we just released a full 86-minute masterclass on how we developed youth players and teams in simple and easy to apply ways. These are the same methods that I used with local teams here in Los Angeles that have gone from getting beat by 30 to beating teams by 30. At Basketball Immersion, we coach kids for the long term, so they're still engaged, confident, and improving later in their basketball career, not just winning games at 8, 9, and 10. When you join, you get access to a youth coaching masterclass that's transforming programs around the world, plus our full library of incredible ready-to-use resources and courses. This masterclass alone is worth the investment, and your players will thank you. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sales today to get started. I want to get into your offensive stuff because I've watched some clips. I've seen you guys. Again, seems a lot of freedom on offense with some concepts and alignments and different things like that. But let's start with Transition O because I know you have some unique things that make it even simpler for your players.
Yeah, Transition O is the most important thing for us. We spend pretty much the whole preseason up until we're about to play our first scrimmage without having a set play in. So all the way until, I don't remember exactly when our first scrimmage was, but let's say October 20th, without really teaching sets. So we try to focus on our transition offense, then we'll build to our primary or secondary breaks and our concepts. But I think that's the easiest time to score. Defenses are not set. We try to push the ball hard off makes and misses. I like to play with four guards, usually my fourth guard, which are, that's why I don't have positional coaches because there's no positions really. But our biggest guard is your traditional four, I guess. At least that's who that person guards on the other team. Even that person can bring it up. And this year I was lucky enough to have a starting five man that could dribble. So if I have a player that can do that, she can bring it up too. And now everybody's running. We very simple transition rules. You can never pass behind you until you get inside the 3-point line. So if my center gets a rebound, a long rebound that goes to the free throw line, and my point guard is below the free throw line, she's not giving it to her to push it. I only allow forward passes, pitch aheads, or sideway passes. And we're always hunting the one-on-one matchup. So when you have the ball, if you look in front of you and you only see you and your player, there's no help between you guys and the basket, you're attacking, you're getting to the rim. And I'm okay with living with the bad shot that comes from that. Because I feel like more often than not, you're either going to get a layup or you're going to get fouled. And then maybe one third of the time, it's a contested layup or a contested little floater that I think at that point you have to live with it. And so that
Do you have a
it's
set
pretty.
arrival spacing like that you prefer, or is that flexible as well?
No, it's flexible as well. If a guard, I usually have lanes. I want my guards to run the outside lanes and usually the five to run the middle alley is what I call. But anytime the guards cross the half court line, they can cross over into the middle alley for the centers. So if the center is not there, we don't have a rim runner. As a guard, if you start wide and that you can cut into the basket, you can do that after you cross half court, not before. I don't want our guards to run in the middle alley before we get to the half court because I want that spacing. I want us to be able to pitch ahead. And now, if you have a one-on-one situation, let's say we pitch ahead to the left wing and it's a one-on-one situation, you have the whole court to attack. From the left side, you have the entire right side to use. So it's, I'm not picky about you. This person runs the left lane, this person runs the right lane. I want them to figure out to communicate and react. It makes it messy early in the season because sometimes we end up with a double-sided break, but that's not bad either. Sometimes it's hard for the defense to guard a double-sided break. And same thing on makes. The closest person takes it out. That was a concept that Drew, my associate head coach, got me to believe in. I was worried about that. Because my biggest concern was, I've always had the four take the ball out. If we don't designate somebody, are you and I just going to be looking at each other when the ball goes through the net? I was like, Chris, do you go? Do I go? And now you lose that speed, right? But probably after the first month, that was never a problem. The girls just figured out we kept doing it. It looked ugly early on, but 1 month in, we never had an issue with it anymore.
And it actually does speed you up if you can get it, right? And that's a beautiful thing. That's always been my preference to do it that way. And we're always going to try and do it that way for coaches' reference. And then, as you said, you reference, you get to a certain point in the season, and then you've got to make a decision, but you don't lose by trying that first.
No doubt, no doubt.
That's awesome. I love hearing this stuff about transition. With arrival spacing, then I love it. Go score. You have one player on you, go score, you draw two, you pass, very simple advantage type of situations. Talk to us about spacing then off the ball. When you've got a player who's got an advantage and they're attacking the advantage, what is our preference in terms of spacing off the ball?
Yeah, so it depends on if everybody has arrived or not. If we're in more of a almost like the half court setting where we have three or four players that are already past that half court line. I based a lot of our offensive system and concepts on what he did at Paris and what he's doing with the Grizzlies, where it's a note. I learned that when I was maybe 10 years old, and then people got away from it, and now it's back, right? Where you drive the ball towards the right side of the floor, then everybody just rotates over to the right. If you have somebody in the corner, now you can have a corner cut. If you have somebody on the wing, then get spaced out to the corner. You're just moving towards the direction that the ball is. If it's a little more of a, let's say, a 2-on-1 situation or a 3-on-2, where not everybody's set yet, we always try to have somebody behind the ball, because I love that footwork where you punch the paint and then you stride stop or you jump stop, reverse pivot, wherever you want to do, and then you have somebody right there. So we'll always have somebody behind the ball, but we'll always have somebody opposite moving towards the window that the passer can see you. We use the concept to never be three in a row. So if there's the ball handler, there's a defender, you can't be in the same line as them. You have to give the passer a window. So again, the same thing with defense. We don't have set rules like you have to be on the spot, you have to be there. But I want them to understand the concepts and understand the why, because then they'll get to the right spots. If you understand you have to be in a window and you can't be three in a row, then perfect. You're going to find yourself at the right spot.
If you have the fifth player there, so they've already arrived, are you preferring dunker spot spacing? Are you okay? You already mentioned imperfect spacing is sometimes good spacing. So maybe talk to us about when the fifth player has arrived.
Yeah, I like our fives to rim run. I think the true five out spacing is actually bad spacing. No, when
Agreed.
there's five players in the perimeter, then there's nowhere to go, really. I
Yeah,
mean, people are
agreed.
just setting gaps. I love when we play against five out and there's no movement where they just try to ISO you, because for us, they're playing gaps. It just makes it easy for us. So we try to get them to the rim. The only time I'll let them trail is if we do have somebody punching the paint. Now you can be in the perimeter, you can follow behind the ball. But if not, I want them to dive to the basket and then put them in the dunker spot. This year, I was lucky enough that I had, in my opinion, the two best post players in the league. And one of them was a beast on the block. So she started a dunker spot. If the ball got to her side, I gave her the freedom to duck in right away. And even if there's a drive coming your way at the side that she's in, if you don't have time to tee up or circle under, whatever you want to call those relocation, the basic dribble drive concepts, I taught her to duck in as well and then clear the help side defender. Don't feel like you have to. Let's say there's a middle drive coming towards you, you're on the opposite block. You don't have to necessarily circle under to the other side. If you feel like you don't have time to get there, just duck in and clear out the help side. And now maybe the guard has a layup. Or if it doesn't, now the post player has to fight around you to help. It's probably going to be late to help. And if that guard misses the layup, that's an easy putback for you. And again, I give them a lot of freedom, but I think it depends on the type of personnel that you have too. I had also had a 6'5" girl that she only wanted to play on the dunker spot, and she was really good from there. So she didn't duck in as much. She didn't post up as much. She was probably more of your traditional dribble drive post. So we adjusted the personnel that we have.
So if your big is behind the play, for example, who you wanted to have rim run or duck in, then they're just running through the action and getting to the rim still.
So we're very specific with what actions we get to. It's dictated by where the ball is. So if we pitch ahead and there's no advantage, most of the time we're going to get into drag screen instead of having them go to the rim. Or if the point guard can pitch ahead, they stop us and you're dribbling the ball, that's going to be a drag screen. But if we have a dribble penetration, we try to still get them to the rim, because a lot of times you end up getting a layup if you outrun the other big.
So I love talking about this, and because I think coaches overthink a lot of things, and that's one of the things they overthink is that if you're into a pitch ahead and a drive to score type of situation, you don't have five there. It's better to not have five there, and don't worry about that fifth player because they'll figure it out relative to where the ball goes. As you said, drive towards you, move this way, drive away, move that way. Awesome. Love it. Okay, so you mentioned the actions. Talk to us then. What are some triggers? So you said location of the ball. Is it location of players too?
Yeah, absolutely. We don't really call anything out of transition. We let whoever is handling the ball initiate the action, and then everybody else knows. So there's a couple triggers. If we have a spacing where, let's say, we pitch ahead or we dribble the ball towards one of the sides, and there's somebody already in that corner, it most of the time is going to be an automatic. We didn't get to as much a pistol action this year. Our girls didn't love it, but it would either be a pistol action or just a dribble handoff into a ball screen. That goes right away. Or if we can't get to a dribble handoff, then it can reverse through the trail. Then we have another set of action that is different. It triggers something else. We just have a lot of those little things that, depending on what that ball handler does, everybody else knows what comes next. And because we do it that way, we're not calling things, you can't have 10, 15 different options, because they're not going to remember it. I'm still trying to figure out the sweet spot. I think Four, five is a good number that everybody can remember and get good at it. And that's what we stick with.
That makes sense. And how are you? You mentioned doing this, and I love this idea, by the way. I hope coaches caught that, is this idea of if you want to be good in transition, then don't teach set plays early in the season. I love that idea. But talk to us again. How do you actually practice this? What are some things you're doing to be able to help develop, especially the drive to score mentality?
So right now, for example, in the spring and early in the summer when the girls get back, we do tons of different one-on-one situations in transition where maybe just a player starts at half court, defender starts in the middle of the floor, coach pitches the ball ahead, and then you're attacking that matchup. We'll do a lot of little things like that. One of my favorite drills that our assistant Drew brought up to us this year was we do a lot of one-on-one and no dribble in the paint. Because I want you to have an answer when you get stuck out there. It's not just drive as deep as you can, and now you pick the ball up, and it's hard to, because the deeper you get, the harder it is to find a pass too. You can get yourself in no man's land there and get yourself in trouble. So we spend a lot of time working on footwork and working on one-on-one where you don't have a dribble, so we can use our feet to create angles to get to the rim or get fouled. So it's a lot of skill work within the offense early on. We'll do a lot of 3-on-0 full court situations where we're working on moving with and without the ball. Then I'll add that fourth person, go to 4-on-0. Then we'll go to 5-on-0. And once I feel like we're really good at our concepts, we'll try to add the secondary break with those things I'm telling you about, where the ball kind of dictates where action we're in. But I like to do most of the stuff in the full court. If we want to play fast, I don't think it makes a lot of sense to work on your transition offense or your secondary break in the half court. And I'm also not a huge fan of 5-on-0. So once I feel like they learned it, we're going to put defense on it. I think it's a great concept,
I
but
knew we got
unfortunately,
along.
the
I
game's
knew we
not
got
played
along.
5-1-0.
I know we get along. It just resonates with me what you're saying so much, because obviously I'm in the youth space more now than the college space, but I can't tell you how many girls I get into one of my practices and I literally tell them, go score. They don't know what to do. And I say, okay, wait a minute. Do you work with a trainer? Yes. Do they teach you moves? Yes. Here's where you use them.
No
They've
doubt.
never connected that. Nobody's ever connected that before. Like, they just go and learn all these moves and then they don't know where to use them. And I'm like, it's real simple. If you draw one score and if you draw two pass, there you go. Go score.
I feel like sometimes as coaches, we try to reinvent the wheel too, and basketball is actually a pretty simple game.
Simple is sophisticated. Simple is sophisticated. Mac Driscoll said that on the podcast a long time ago, and I cannot share that enough with people.
No doubt.
So that's great. I love this concept. I knew watching you guys play, it's just a fun style. It connects. It seems to connect with your personality as well. The overall offense then. So you're neutral. Let's say half court stuff, referee handles the ball, you're calling out a specific action. But when you're neutral, talk to me about re-triggering. Because I think that's where some people get stuck with conceptual offense, is that they get the concept of the first trigger, which you've already explained to us. But what happens if we don't score off that first trigger?
Then we fall into our basic concepts of how we move without the ball, like we talked about what Memphis does and what Thomas did at Paris. That's when you rely a lot on that. So I give them a lot of freedom once that initial action breaks. Like you can pass and almost get into dribble drive a little bit. I think every team needs to learn dribble drive offense, not because you want to run it, but I feel like once your set breaks down, that's what happens anyway. That's what everybody gets down to. If even when there's a dead ball situation, we call a set, when that breaks down, almost every offense becomes similar to dribble drive in a way. I give them a lot of freedom to brush cut, to I call ghost wash here. We teach a lot of those concepts because so guards can open up the defender's hips and create a driving lane, and then everybody knows how to rotate behind. But with the half court offense, it's also a situation where I think we need to adapt to personnel. Regardless of the team that I have, my transition, my defense, and our offensive rebounding philosophies are going to be the same. But I change our half court offense according to what I have. My first year, I couldn't be as selective in the portal. So I end up with a more traditional two big offense with a classic four and your typical five. So then once everything broke down, we'll find ourselves into the Aussie flow motion style, and that's what we would run. This year, once everything broke down, we're more dribble drive-ish. But I always teach the same concepts because even if you are running the flow ball screen motion, I still want, if there's a ball screen and then you get middle, you get past the half court line, I still want to cut that corner. Or if there's a pop, I want to cut the pop. Or if there's a roll, I want to lift the roll. So some of those concepts stay the same regardless of what we do. But I am not afraid of adjusting our half court offense to our personnel. I think it's really hard to recruit talent and recruit the right type of people. So I'll do that first, and then I'll figure out what we need to run to put them in the best positions to be successful.
Love it. Very logical, connects very deeply with a simple style of play, which I love. And what's not so simple sometimes is this concept of tagging up, which I know you've messed around with and you've used successfully. So talk to us about that. More and more, you're seeing coaches do it, but you're seeing many coaches try it and then not continue with it.
I love the idea behind it, but I felt like once I went down the rabbit hole of studying it, most of the teams that I watch, when you really break down the numbers, their transition defense improved, which I found out that's probably why they do it, but it didn't necessarily translate into better offensive rebounding numbers or, which is more important to me, second chance points. There's still a value of getting an offensive rebound if you don't score because you're keeping the other team from going offense and you're limiting their possessions. But I just wanted to be a little more aggressive with it. I want to get easy. I feel like basketball sometimes we forget that if we can score easy, it's good. It's very simple. My offensive concept is let's try to dominate the easy points. And then on defense, let's try to keep our opponents from getting the easy points, right? So I changed a little bit how we teach tagging up. I still call it tagging up, but it's different than your typical one. I had that idea watching our football team practice and how players break through tackles, running backs. So I teach them to crash towards the middle of the floor through their top shoulder, just like most teams that tag up did. Because if you get caught on that bottom side and there's a long rebound, you're in trouble. But then you're on an automatic disadvantage there in transition. Still crash towards the middle of their top shoulder. But if they box you out, the term I use is you got to run through their shoulder. You're not stopping on their back. So just like a football running back, I teach them to dip their shoulder and drive you away from the middle of the floor. So even if you box me out, I'm still dipping my shoulder and use the momentum as I'm running to try to drive you away from the middle of the floor. So now everybody can get the rebound. And what that does is we crash so hard that you as a defender, now you have to turn around and find me because I'm coming at you full speed. I tell our girls that even if they don't box you out, I still want you to clip them because when you play as fast as we do, we put as much ball pressure as we do. And if you're physical on the rebounding, at some point teams are going to wear out. So what happens is people have to turn around to find you. And when they do that, they lose sight of the ball. But me, because I'm running on a straight line, I see the ball at all times. So if there's a bounce that goes the other way, because you had to turn around and find me, you can't react quick enough. And now I can swim and get to the ball. Or if I'm stronger than you, I just push you out of the middle. We're going to get that rebound anyway. So I felt like it was really successful for us. I think we're 20th in the country in offensive rebounding percentage, and we're like top 10 in second chance points with a team that is not that athletic, is not that big. And then on the counter side of it, if we don't get the offensive rebound, we try to put as much pressure on the ball as possible to delay you from getting into your break. So then that's where the tag up system comes in, is that's going to be your matchup. Whoever box you out, that's who you have. And then we sprint back and we try to clog the middle of the floor. And if they pitch ahead, then you match up from there. But we don't have specific matchups in transition defense. That one is similar to the tagging up system where whoever boxed you out, that's your matchup.
Makes sense. And you're creating an aggressive mindset, an aggressive mentality. And I would say that is the extreme benefit of tagging up as a philosophy, is that it's great for transition defense. So you're applying that internationally, like again, like 30, 40 years ago, I remember like jamming the rebounder and jamming the outlet were such a big part of the game. So it's that being applied as well.
And that's our rule. You want to jam that rebounder and then you want to force the outlet to happen below the free throw line if you can. That's my goal. So if they start to get a higher outlet, you're denying that and forcing them back down. We work on that every day in practice. Spend 2 minutes on it every single day from July until the end of the year. Whenever we lost to Oklahoma in March, we would do that every day in practice for 2 minutes, just those simple 2-on-2 tagging up drills to work on all of that stuff.
Again, speaks to adaptability. Tagging up, we don't have to literally do it, but there's concepts from it that apply, and you've done a great job, obviously, adapting it, which is such an important part of it. How do you protect player confidence while also being honest?
I think that's when the relationship comes in and when the numbers help. Because we stat so much practice and not your typical stats, right? We talk about the pin percentage. We do the same thing offensively. We'll stat not only your field goal percentage, but all of that, the passes that you made, and hockey assists, paint touches, all of that. So I think it makes it really easy when you're having those honest conversations. You have data to back you up, that they don't feel like you're just coming after them. And then when we're playing, like on the sideline, for better or worse, I don't correct them very often because I want you to have confidence when you're playing the game. It would happen a lot where you play a terrible game And I might say something right there, but keep it minimum to keep your confidence up. But then I'll bring you to the office a day later and we'll watch film. And I'm going to say, Chris, what the heck are you thinking here? You made so many bad decisions, took stupid shots. But I don't do it in a game setting because I never want my players to play with that fear of looking back every time they make a mistake. You make a mistake, go get the ball back. And I try to not sub them out after mistakes either because I feel like it builds that habit of, okay, I messed up, I'm coming out. If I can't avoid doing it, I will. Now, sometimes it happens where I was going to make a sub anyway because that's the rotation, right? And then they turn it over, they're coming out. I was like, okay, I didn't take you out because of
And it
that. She
wasn't for
was
that
already at the
reason.
table.
It was
But
already there.
yeah, but I have set rotations. We'll adjust during the game, but one of the biggest things I really like doing this year, I delegated all of that. I delegated half court play calling, I delegated blobs, I delegated subs. I would meet with my assistants in charge of that before the game, leading up to the game, and kind of tell them what I want and the things that I want to run that game or the things that the subs that I want to happen. And then they'll manage it because that allows me to focus on the game and making the adjustments. I feel like as a head coach, it's really hard for you to do everything. And then if I'm doing the subbing, but I'm also play calling, I'm also worried about the defense, I'm also trying to figure out what coverage they're in so I can adjust, then a lot of times my subbing will be reactionary. We will be okay. So and so messed up. All right, get her out. I feel like that really helped me stay focused and be able to adjust better, which was probably our biggest strength this year, is how well we adjusted in games. But I was only able to do that because my mind was free as I was able to delegate all that stuff to my staff.
Another maybe benefit, at least for me, I'm curious your thoughts, but as I did that later in my career, I found I was communicating less directly to players, which removed a lot of emotional moments from the game.
Yeah, no doubt. No
So my
doubt.
assistants were more calm, they were less invested, so to speak, in all these different things. So it removed something emotionally for me.
No doubt. Absolutely.
You've coached internationally. I love asking people that have been internationally. What are some insights that you carried over from some of your international experiences with Brazil that have helped you?
Yeah, I think you learn so much when you coach at that level. I got to coach the U19 World Cup, and I watch a lot of EuroLeague, so I've seen concepts that are not as common in the US as the next ball screen coverage, all that stuff, hot, and all those concepts that we don't have a lot in college, especially on the women's side. I feel like every time I get to coach overseas, I learn something new. The first time I saw a team peel switching against us when I was at the national team, I was like, oh my God, what is happening? How did they always have somebody at the ball? At this, I feel like they couldn't guard the ball at all, but at the same time, we could never get to the paint. So I just feel like the game is so far ahead over there. I got to spend 2 weeks with Barcelona at their youth academy when I was an assistant at San Francisco, and I got to see their whole player development plan. They had a system from when you start playing at whatever U10 all the way to U18, and it's a continuous progression. We'll teach this at 12 years old, we'll teach this at 13. And I just feel like people are so creative, and the fundamental part of it is so important overseas. That's what I took from it. I felt like now I've been able to combine a lot of those concepts and the way of teaching the game from there. And now I get my American players who are super competitive, more athletic, and more one-on-one driven. Now I have the best of both worlds, right? I'm teaching the European concepts, but now applying to the US athletes that we have here. And then you have what we have when you win 29 games.
You say that, and I want to bring that home for people a little bit. Like, certainly, you talk about the progressions, you talk about fundamentals, but what everyone always points to about Europe or internationally is players seem to have higher basketball IQ.
Yeah.
How do you account for that kind of thing? When you describe what you describe, it's American coaches going, I do that, but
Right.
there's something that's different.
Yeah, I just think is overseas you practice more than you play. And here in the US at the youth level, I feel like you play more than you practice. And which is not necessarily a bad thing because I do think you need to play basketball, right? There's a lot of stuff you don't learn in the game, but I feel like you have so much practice time there. When I grew up in Brazil, we would practice 4 to 5 days a week and then we'll play once. We'll have one game every single week and 4 or 5 days of practice. So then you're developing those skills, and people focus on teaching the game. They teach concepts. They're not as play heavy. You're not trying to play one-on-one isolation because you're trying to get seen by a college at the AAU circuit. So I don't think it's necessarily overseas players are born with a higher IQ. I just think it's the youth setup sets them to think the game better than it does here.
More problem-solving situations and safe spaces might be my argument to
Yeah.
that. What you just described from what I share is literally that is like in America, and again, America's the best basketball playing country in the world. It's not even close. The competition model, though, has players doing what they're good at more often, rather than exploring other possibilities and other possible decisions. The practice model gives them a space to be able to do that. So just to articulate what you just said, in my opinion, that's what you said, because you nailed it. And then that may be the deeper reason.
Yeah, and even playing pickup. When I was in Barcelona, I went to a park to play pickup, and everybody was sharing the ball. Everybody was cutting. People that don't play competitive basketball, and I feel like a lot of times that I go play a noon ball here, everybody's just jacking the shots around.
Absolutely. I got to get mine. I got to get mine. It's so funny how basketball somewhat is a culture of a society, somewhat too.
No doubt.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. So, if you were a high school coach and took, let's say, one principle, what from your season and from your success and applied it tomorrow to your high school program, do you have an idea what that would be?
It would be to give them less solutions and allow them to figure it out more. We just get so caught up with the pressure of winning that we lose sight of the big picture. And I feel like at the youth level, the most important thing should be to develop players and prepare them for the next level. And I know there's a lot of high schools that you could lose your job for wins and losses, but I think there's a balance there. And if you truly believe in it and you apply it, I think the wins are going to come. And you can't just be short-sighted. You have to think long term. You have to think about the development of the players and making them be able to think the game and come up with their own solutions.
Great answer. And since you went there, like, they're not all equal, though. That's the one thing. So, talk to us about how you balance that. Even within your team, they're not all equal, even though, like, we do want to give them somewhat equal opportunities at a level like yours.
Yeah, you mean the players
Yeah.
individually? Yeah, absolutely. There's players that they'll have an easier time picking things up and players that don't. I think that's your job as a coach to figure out each person, and you don't have to coach them the same. I know. That's another thing I grew up with. My coach was like, I'm going to treat every single one of you the same. I'm going to be the same coach that I am to Chris, I am to Arthur, I am to everybody else. And I just feel like that doesn't work as well anymore. At least for me. I don't think there's an absolute in basketball. Maybe there's a lot of coaches that are successful doing that way. But I feel like every person is different and you have to coach accordingly. There might be somebody that you need that needs a little more structure. And we do that within our program. When we were running flow last year, I had a lot of players that weren't great making decisions in ball screens. And then one of the simple rule for them is whenever you're going to use a ball screen to your left hand that you're not comfortable with, you're going to reject that screen every time until we get you better on it. So I feel like it's okay to coach everybody different and give them roles within your offensive system and within the team that helps them be successful.
Yeah, great answer. It speaks to this CLA and constraint-led approach. It adds a language to it. But before you even worry about what that is, coaches, if you don't care about CLA, what it does is that you're just accounting for the individual more. Individual constraint is still arguably the most powerful constraint, because they are individually as players different, and they're different in their comfort level with different things as well.
No
So
doubt.
that's such a great answer. I've been to Idaho. I've been to Moscow, Idaho, right?
Yeah.
But I've been to Idaho. It's beautiful. And the support, that's what stood out in researching a bunch. Like, how many articles referenced how much great support you got from the community, from administration, et cetera. So talk to us a little bit about that. That must have been pretty cool.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I think it's the reason we haven't lost players. In my 2 years as a head coach, we had a total of zero rotation players getting the portal, which you don't see it very often anymore. A lot of it is our program and our culture, but I think a big part of it is our community. We sold out the student section where we play Montana State. Whoever won that game was going to take the number one seed. And it's very rare at the mid-major level you have a sold out student section for a women's basketball game. Our girls, they can't go into the store or the grocery store or the restaurant without people talking about the season, talking about the games. For the international kids, for example, that it's harder for them to go home during holidays. There's local families that we invite them over for Thanksgiving, invite them over for Christmas. So they develop those ties and it makes it a really hard place to leave. We don't have professional sports. So Idaho football, women's basketball, men's basketball is what everybody wants to watch. And I feel like it just makes a very special environment to go to school when you have that much support, you feel that much love. I have the three Brazilians on the team this year that I never thought they would enjoy being in Idaho, right? They're all from big cities. One of them is from São Paulo, which has 20 million people. The other one is from Rio, and Moscow, Idaho has 25 to 30,000, but they love their experience here. They had a family that hosted them for Easter the other day, and now they're going, now they're off season to watch that family's kids play basketball, play volleyball. It just creates that family environment. And I think nowadays in the transfer culture that you need that to be able to retain players.
That is so cool to hear. And I'm so grateful for you. When I started following your team this year and heard your story and everything else, it was really cool to see the impact and see the progress of your program and everything that you do. And grateful to be able to have you share the game with us. So thanks so much, Arthur.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Like I said, I've been listening to you for a long time. It's an honor to be here with you.